Michael Bevan, regularly dubbed as the world's best limited overs batsman. I will never forget as a kid watching Michael Bevan coming in nerveless, batting and juggling off the tail, securing nail-biting victories, picking the gaps, running hard, and knowing the right moment and place to hit a boundary, find a way to be able to win it for Australia.
He'll probably pitch it in towards the leg stump and the full. It's down, that's four! That's victory for Australia! What an effort!
Although he was a hero with one-day cricket, he really struggled with Test cricket. And we dive in deep in this conversation about what happened during that time. Why didn't he make it in Test cricket? Something was blocking him. Michael and I are sitting down casually at Manly Oval, where there is a game of cricket playing behind us. You're gonna hear birds chirping, appeals, trucks. It's raw as. I'm really grateful for the time I had with Michael. So you should head to his website, battingmentor.com, for this free online mentoring with Michael himself about how to improve your performance. It's really, really amazing. So please enjoy my episode with Michael Bevan. Here at the Sydney Cricket Ground, aren't we? Sydney, it's Australia versus India behind us, is it, Michael?
Yep, everyone's got their masks on. Everyone's safe, we're all good.
Mate, I remember distinctly, I was playing for Newcastle Cricket Club, and I remember seeing you lead us home many times in one day cricket. For me, I've always wanted to meet you because your coolness, your cool-headedness, but you'd go out when Australia was, you know, 6 for 31 or something, or 37 or something, with Glenn McGrath or someone batting. Have you always been calm-headed when there's pressure involved?
Well, look, it's a really interesting question. And in one day, as yes, in particular, that was always really natural for me. I had an approach that was probably the first of its kind in one day cricket. It worked for me, and I didn't really understand my approach at that point in time until I probably finished and thought about why I did well, why I didn't do well, and, you know, why successful in one day cricket. But say in Test cricket, where I didn't have as good as record and I felt more under pressure at other times in Test cricket, but for one day cricket in particular, I was very clear and I was very comfortable about being in that situation, and I had really good plans. And I think my personality type really suited that role in terms of being reliable, dependable. And I felt that intrinsically it was my job to get Australia home. And so I was always comfortable with that aspect. When I walked to the crease, it was quite often that was the point in time where there was no pressure because everyone expected us to lose the game.
And expectations are low then from other people.
Correct, and myself. I mean, I really didn't feel as though I was going to win the game for Australia, but I knew my job was just to be there at the end. So any sort of short-term or immediate anxiety around the enormity of winning matches was sort of the furthest from my mind at that point in time. When I did get close to winning the match and we had something to lose, then quite often I would get nervous or anxious closer to the end when the match was on the line. You know, it's interesting you say you were, you suffered from anxiety here and there, and, you know, I do as well. It's really interesting and important that when people feel an affinity with a skill or a situation or a circumstance that sort of suits their strengths, it tends to evaporate a little bit. So in some ways, it's always going to be a bit natural when you put yourself out of your comfort zone for something that might not be your forte.
Was this something that you noticed, like a behaviour or pattern that you noticed, you dealing with pressure, being comfortable with it from that early age? You kind of like, oh, I can do this, like this is actually all right, and people started giving you that feedback?
My first recollection of actually winning a game for my team was probably when I was 19 or 20 and I was playing at the Australian Cricket Academy, the AIS in Adelaide, and we were playing grade cricket and we were in a final playing at the SACA ground, the South Australian Cricket Ground, Adelaide Oval. And again, I was in that situation where we were chasing runs in a final, and I think I scored 100. Got the team home, and that was from a pretty young age. I didn't think about how or why I was doing it. I just did it. And, you know, the thing when you're sort of playing for Australia or when you're playing, you don't read too much into what other people are sort of thinking or saying or how they feel about you. It's just what you do. And so in a sense, you don't really build it up too much. You don't really build it down too much. I didn't think too much about it, really. So I guess I would have to say that I did have that ability, innate ability to feel calm, to plan my innings, to understand the factors within each one day game that would determine what was the right game plan for any situation. And so that was a big feature of one of the reasons why I cope with the pressure, is that I just had very good game plans that fitted my strengths, I guess.
There's obviously the technical side of cricket, but then you're talking a lot about this. What's your view, what's your philosophy on mindset in that sense of technical ability versus mindset and preparation there?
So it's a really good question. And when I was at the academy at the age of 19 and the sort of psychologist at that stage, and the mindset wasn't a huge part of the game at that point in time, it was very old school, but they sort of asked us how much would you attribute the mental game to success, and I can remember putting like 10% or 15%. It really didn't crop up for me, the mental side, until probably halfway through my career at the age of 27, when I'd been dropped from the test team twice for the same reason. I was probably at my lowest in my career, and it was the first time I sort of acknowledged that there was something greater than talent or hard work, and that it was to do with me.
Yeah, right.
And so I didn't learn my lesson till very late as a cricketer, and it was a bit of an eye-opener for me in terms of how much your sense of self impacts what you do on a day-to-day basis, I guess.
I can already tell you've got a good head on your shoulders. You think deeply about the game and probably about most things in your life. I'm very similar in that sense. I think deeply about things, and sometimes thinkers can get into a pit, so to speak.
Yeah, definitely.
What were some of those patterns that affecting your game?
Yeah, look, I'm definitely an analytical guy. I'm definitely an overthinker. And when you're batting, you actually just want to let go and react. And so there are times when you've just got to sort of work out, look, am I thinking too much here? But for me, it was probably broader than that. You know, I had things that affected me growing up. Things like, I placed a lot of pressure on myself. I was a pessimistic guy by nature. I worried too much about what people thought of me. And so I suppose there can be a number of aspects or factors that go into what affects people at any one time. So you kind of got to sift through all that and be really, ultimately, really honest with yourself, and really aware about what's affecting. And that can be really hard, and it can be a challenge for a lot of people because they don't necessarily analyse themselves with any degree of honesty, which is, I think, a really good starting point to moving to a space where you start to get control over who you are, what you do, and your enjoyment levels too. So for me, look, I had all those aspects that cropped up during my career that I was unaware of initially. And so I found from the sort of middle of my career to the end of my career, I actually didn't even work on cricket. I just worked on myself and spent most of my time just trying to feel comfortable out in the middle, feeling good about myself, feeling confident. And I really had to work pretty hard at that.
Yeah, wow. Because it begs the question, like, so in sport, you have got stats, you've got statistics, you've got averages, and you can watch games back on yourself and go, oh yeah, you weren't forward enough, you were blah, 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 blah. But really, when it comes to our character, when it comes to our mental health, when it comes to our own stuff, which isn't so visible, you can't film what's going on in here. Yeah. Oftentimes, like you said, people, they're not honest with themselves, and they tend to surround themselves with people that will support their own biases.
What I would say is that there's probably two aspects to that. At the moment, I've sort of, I'll be launching a cricket mentoring service shortly, but one of the things that I did to precede that is write an ebook, and it'll be a free ebook, but it's about 15 pages, and it's just called the four four batting secrets or four secrets to batting, what every batsman needs to know. Catchy, right? And so my starting point or the first secret is basically, look, what do you know the attributes that you need to achieve the goals that you want? And so as a starting point, I don't think many people actually understand what attributes they need. So there's a certain amount of performance knowledge you need to know. And then once you know that, you can move on to the second secret and sort of assess yourself and get more of an understanding about, you know, where you sit in terms of each of those attributes, I suppose. So I suppose there's two aspects to that. Is one, do I know sort of the enough about success or performance or the things that I need to help me? And two, where do I sort of sit in those parameters? So it's sort of knowledge, it's self-knowledge and then sort of performance knowledge or success knowledge or whatever you want to call it. So you sort of kick it, you know, click in to those two parameters or criteria, then you've got a bit of a starting point, I think.
Hey guys, I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. I just want to ask a 30-second favor. I don't sell anything on my podcast, it's totally free. And I want to ask, if you're enjoying this episode, how about you take a screenshot right now or send it to a friend to be able to listen to it too. I've also had interviews over the years with Guy Sebastian, Mark Burris, Janine Ellis from Boost Juice from Shark Tank, and many more. This is the way that our podcast can get out there and get more exposure, so I really appreciate the time. Now back to the episode.
I want to dive a little bit into, you know, your idea of mentorship. You have a service that you're going to launch very soon, but talk us through about your experience. Mentorship in a lot of ways is fairly a new term that's been used a lot the last while. It's been professionalized in a way. It can come in a few forms, like sometimes involuntarily people just want to give you advice when it's not asked of you. Talk us through a little bit about your mentors or influences.
Yeah, it's a really good question, the difference between mentoring and coaching, and you know, there's probably some similarities there in some perspectives and differences in others. But for me, look, I've always had, I guess, the traditional coaches. So when I was young, I was actually a fast bowler, and so I had my bowling coach there, and again, it was all very technical. And then team coaches, and then batting coaches within the team, and then of course the leaders within the team, and so, which are probably the most important aspects, because what you find in any team that does really well, usually there's a high caliber or quality of leaders within that team, and then when you get to when you're part of a team that's not doing so well, you know, generally the leadership is non-existent, or if it's a poor quality, and so quite often it can just be through again, you know, through leadership as opposed to coaching or mentorship, in terms of saying, look, follow me, this is what we're going to do. And so it's you really don't have a hand in it. You get dragged through it and taught, supported that this is what we're going to do as a team, this is what we need, et cetera, et cetera. And you either choose to fall in or you don't. And so, you know, quite often, and I've been fortunate in a sense that I've been a part of some really great teams. Obviously the Australian team that I played with for a number of years was one of the strongest in any era. The New South Wales team, particularly when I started in early 90s with New South Wales, and next I think we played four Shield finals in a row, and so we just had this habit of winning. And then again I played in some teams that haven't been that successful, and it's kind of like, well, no one really wants to be there. There's sort of infighting, and you know, it's not quite as enjoyable, not quite as productive, and you know, it's always a little bit harder. So through a kind of combination of sort of coaches or mentoring and leadership, you usually sort of find what you need from any of those sources moving forward, I guess. So, you know, but everyone is going to have, the most important thing out of all that is that you have someone that you have a deeper than surface level relationship with, and you can be really honest about what you're going through, how you're feeling, what's affecting you, because, you know, regardless of the quality of the teams that I played with, it's all a very ego-driven environment. And there are times where you feel, as a person, you can't always be yourself, or you can't always let go or broach certain things with certain people. So I think one of the most important aspects, whether it's family, whether it's coach, whether it's mentor, is that the quality of the relationship is such that you feel completely comfortable divulging what you're going through. And if you can get that kind of relationship, you're going to get a far better result. So I guess what I mean by that is, if I'm coaching a team or a individual, the first thing on my checklist is to develop a trust and respect. And so I don't go into the technical side of things. I don't go into the deep stuff. I don't go anywhere until I've established a base level of trust and respect, because I know that unless I get that, people aren't going to give me what I need from them for me to push them into the space that they need to be. So for me, just as a coach, I know I have to work hard on that aspect when I'm coaching or dealing with people. And, you know, look, there are a couple of ways you can do that, but that's got to be the first box you've got to tick.
Where did this come from, you know, like the desire to want to coach? Because you could have retired, you know, and you did, and moved on to something completely outside of cricket, and that's totally fine, people have done that. Why this for you?
It's an interesting question, and I've kind of resisted coaching for a long while. And I guess there are a number of reasons why I've resisted and haven't really understood, but I think the reason why I'm moving into the space that I'm moving now, which is sort of online mentoring, which kind of deals with the aspects that players don't receive support in terms of mindset, in terms of game plans, in terms of goal setting. So I'm kind of dealing with all the things that are under the surface, not surface level sort of technical skills issues. And so going back to your previous question, is that the thing that interests me about coaching is the challenge of creating change. And once I've done that, and once I've spoken to someone, and I feel as though I've got some cut through, and they're moving to a different space, then they'll go away and work on the nets for hours and hours on their skills. Right. And that's the part that actually really bores me. In terms of batting coaching, you know, you spend a lot of time in the nets just doing, I won't say mundane, they're very important. They're dealing with sort of the moment after the light bulb, or after the part where you're saying, this is the strategy or the tactics I'm going to need to improve my game. Right. So until that part's dealt with, you can't move into that other space. And so for me, they're the parts that I quite enjoy, is just sort of having this chat and discussing games, but it's the challenge of it. So, for me, I've done quite a bit of coaching, but the things, not many cricket players love them, but cricket players don't love meetings, but I love meetings because I love talking.
Yeah.
And chatting about sort of deep stuff. So for me, I've really just sort of launched a service that, one, I think is not really done very well in the marketplace. It suits my strengths. And has just come to the fore because of the COVID period where everyone's online and everyone has access now to live streaming and all the things that have never... It's just sort of like all coming together, and I think it's the right time to do it. And look, there are products and services out there that will be similar, well, will claim to be similar to mine, and they might be, they may not be. I'm not too sure, but I have a very clear understanding about what players need to do to shift the performance of their game.
This has obviously helped you in your career. If the horse isn't healthy, the cart, it doesn't matter how pretty the cart is, right?
Yep.
You can go out and try and tonk balls or the ball, but if you're not thinking about what you're doing or what your goals are, like, I know exactly that people often go jump the gun to doing things, do without, well, why, where, how?
Yeah.
It might be actually really foreign to people that listen to cricketers, especially young kids. What do you mean by strategy when I'm a cricket player?
Like, what do you mean by that?
And that's a really important question because, I mean, one of the things that happened when I was playing, particularly for New South Wales when I was a young player, we had all these legends. We had the War Brothers, the Taylor, Slater, Whitney, Matthews. And one of the sayings that we used to have was back yourself. And I never knew what that meant. And so I thought that was just go out and try and smash the crap out of every bowler, which had limited success.
Yeah.
And so I think one of the things that you've got to really do is define whatever concept or topic you're talking about until it's definable, until it's actionable. And you really can't include that into any goal setting. I suppose one of the things that I've tried to do is really, which hasn't been that tough for me because I'm an analytical type of guy, is really just define each concept and what's actually happening when you're doing well. And so I guess if you reverse engineer it and say, right, which is quite often one of the questions I ask players or teams actually, you know, in team meetings is it, right, what are we doing when we're doing well? Or that might be the question I ask someone. And sometimes they don't know. Sometimes you know what they should or shouldn't be doing. So you've got to, you know, you've got to ask. I ask leading questions. And a lot of people don't. A lot of coaches let it unfold and go to a place where the player finds out where, I don't know, whether maybe I'm a little bit impatient or I feel as though that I need to marry up or match between what I know and what they know and I sort of help them get there. So, you know, quite often I'll sort of try and ask leading questions to get them to clarify what it is they think they do when they're doing well, or it could be the exact opposite. Well, when you're not doing well, what are the things that are happening? So, you know, because when I was young, it was, you know, people used to say, oh, you're not watching the ball, or you're not concentrating, you're not focusing. Oh, usually when I play a game of golf before the game of cricket, you know, I do well. And so people have all these raft of reasons why they think they do well, why they don't. My job is to simplify it as much as possible, get it down to a couple of key principles so you can define your goals and have actions and plans to improve those areas. And that's about as simplistic as it gets.
You've talked about how, you know, you had a couple of setbacks and, you know, you thought it was a technical and you really looked at your mindset, you know, when you're 27-ish around that time. What did you do to be able to correct course?
One, I had to really identify the way I was thinking and some of the probably limiting beliefs that I had. As I mentioned previously, I was pessimistic, worried about what people thought of me. I put a lot of pressure on myself. So accompanying all those sort of states were beliefs around sort of every part or aspect of the game. And it might be different. So if you're sort of batting and you get out for a couple of low scores and it's on the back page of the paper and they're saying you're crap and you're feeling under pressure and et cetera, et cetera. So what I basically had to do is just identify what sort of my irrational beliefs were and what were the cognitive behavioural strategies that I wanted to change in terms of how I thought. But I was pretty calculated. So every part of the game, I used to have phrases that I used to repeat. So I used to take sort of negative phrases, turn them into positives, and then repeat them at the key times. For an example is, say, when you're walking out to bat and you're passing the other team and they're chirping and, you know, or you're under pressure. It took a lot of work. And so when I say I spent a lot of time on that at the back end of my career, I probably did that straight for 2 years until I got to the point where it became sort of second nature, or at least dramatically improved my mindset as both as a cricketer and as a person. And so to give you an idea about the change in performance is that after the age of 27, I never really got another shot at the Australian Test team. I played 18 tests and clearly had up and down performance. But at first class level, from the age of 27 to when I finished, my average increased by 25%. So just by concentrating on the mindset aspects of my game delivered really wholesale results for me. And so it's really important for me when I'm speaking to people about their game, I don't want them working on something that's going to improve their game by 1%. I want to get them to the stage and the point where we can make wholesale changes to their game. Yeah. After, you know, taking players through, every player needs to go through this sort of process to establish where do I need to go now, you know, and what do I need to do. So for me, that was my journey, and that was the way I handled some of the mindset issues that were plaguing me throughout my career. So prior to that, I got dropped playing for Australia in 94. I got out to the short ball. I went away and worked on the short ball technically every day for 2 hours. Got back in the test team 2 years later and got out to the short ball again. And so you can't have a lens of yourself as a person. You can't skip or gloss over the things that are really affecting you. So until you really establish what those core things are that are affecting you, you're dealing with surface stuff. And so to me, I think that's one of the biggest challenges people face is getting to the point, to that level of honesty or level of self-awareness, or even before anything else happens. I mean, until you can get to that space, you're probably always going to try sort of materialistic or surface level things that to prop up what you think you want.
You actually can't see your face without a mirror, without reflection. There's a lot of your body that you can never see without the assistance of. I mean, the term "I've got your back" is a war term, which is basically to say, well, I don't have eyes in the back of my head. So it's really important when, and for our listeners, like, if this is all resonating with you, like, it's really important that you take control. And one of the ways you can take control is look at what you can do. And one of those things you can do is reach out to somebody that you can trust, like Michael said. And it could be a professional service. It could be someone who's just within your grasp, or a family member who's got experience there. But the important thing is there's something you can do, and you shouldn't just let those actions that are causing you grief to continue.
And also just personal dispositions as well. I mean, we all have things that affect us, generally speaking. So, yeah, look, I think it's, you know, life at times, you know, is not always easy, but you can, by being vulnerable and honest, you know, you're half a chance of dealing with the stuff that that's affecting you.
Make sure you check out Bev's stuff. So you just started Instagram, which was not long ago. Do you remember your Instagram handle? What's your
Bevo underscore Michael Bevan.
Thanks again, mate. Really
pleasure.
Appreciate it.
Pleasure.